you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me to talk about Limited Collector's Edition number C57, Welcome Back, Cotter, is my pal and frequent Treasury Cast guest, Brian Heiler. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Rob. Pleasure to be here.
I am so happy to have you back. Now, Brian, right off the top of the show, I have to make this confession. You were not my first choice.
What?
As guest. I know, I'm sorry, but I feel like I need to be honest as the host of the show. I did try to reach out to Gabe Kaplan.
Oh, okay.
On Twitter. Yeah. And he did not write back to me, which is not surprising. And no, I don't blame him because he was like, probably who's this weirdo that just added him? But I tried. I figured because I think 3 months into Treasury Cast's existence, you asked me to do this book. Like, we had done the G.I. Joe pretty early on.
Right.
And you said, if I ever do Welcome Back, Cotter, you want to do it. And I was like, wow, like, really? When am I going to get the Welcome Back? Like, that seems like a, you know, like, oh, I'll do that 10 years from now. But you were so enthused about it that I said, well, all right, if we ever do it, I'll have Brian on. But then when I saw, like, a year or two ago, Gabe Kaplan opened up a Twitter account. And he's on it occasionally. And
Nobody demanded it.
But he's funny. Like, he tells jokes. And, like, I think it was funny. And I just had this wild hair of, like, you know what? Let me ask him. So I said, Dear Mr. Kaplan, I would love it if you did. And, of course, he never wrote back. So I felt okay that in the very, you know, rare chance that he would write back, I would be okay bumping you for Gabe Kaplan, because I think you, as Captain 70s, would appreciate that yourself.
I think that goes, I would be an unfair man to be hurt by that, because, you know, star power.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know,
I would also be fine if Lawrence Hilton Jacobs, I don't think Travolta, well, actually, I don't know. Travolta's career is doing
Robert
these days.
Is
Robert Hedges still with us?
I thought so. I think Ron Palillo was the only one Robert
Hedges passed away 9 years ago.
Oh, he did? Oh, Lord. I'm sorry to hear that. I'm so bad. I don't know that. So anyway, but yes. So I tried for Gabe Kaplan, missed. And so I'm more than happy to have you on the show, because you've been on the show.
I would be mad if you bumped me for Bo.
Right. That would have been amazing if I could have gotten that guy. That would have been amazing. You know, your character doesn't appear in any of these stories, but would you like to do the episode? So, as I said, we're here to talk about the Welcome Back, Cotter Treasury. It came out on February 28th, 1978. Now, I was surprised to learn that, because, of course, there was a regular Welcome Back, Cotter comic book that DC
put
out. It was part of their DC TV line. I always assumed that this Treasury was printed in conjunction or concurrently with the series, but that's not the case. The Cotter comic ran from August 76 to December 77. So this thing came a full couple of months, like half, you know, 3 or 4 months later. Now, the Cotter TV show was still on the air. That started in 75 and ran until June 79. So they were still striking while the iron was, if not hot, lukewarm at least. So it makes kind of sense. Yeah.
I just went through that same process. Like, I picked it up again, grabbed it out of the storage and started reading it. And then I would have thought this thing came out like at 76.
Right.
And to see that 78 date was like, really? Like, that's really late in the game.
Yep.
And I wonder what the motivation for it was.
Well, we'll talk about it. I have some small inkling as to what that might be, and we will talk about that briefly. But I want to ask you, Brian, first of all, I have a couple questions related to Welcome Back, Kotter. A,
sure.
Did you watch the show? B, did you buy the comic? And C, I want you to talk a little bit about the surprising amount of merchandising that was done for Welcome Back, Kotter, because this was not, I mean, this is not a superhero show. You would think that it wouldn't be something that would have a lot of merchandising appeal, but apparently licensors were lined up to do products of Welcome Back, Kotter.
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting thing. I did watch the show. In fact, when did that show first air? Let me just...
75 to 79.
Okay, so I watched the pilot as a kid. I would have been 4 years old. And I think whatever station that we had used to play a lot of primetime stuff as repeats in the afternoons, like on a Saturday. I see, because there's no way my parents would have let me watch that at 4 years old. So I think they plunked me in front of the TV and they reran Welcome Back, Kotter, you know, the pilot on like Saturday afternoon. And it's a really funny story because, you know, I came upstairs and I was like, it made an indelible impression on me because, you know, I was like telling my mom, up your nose with a rubber hose, you know, and get off my case toilet face. I remember saying that to my mother at four.
Whoa.
And they thought it was pretty funny, but they were also like, what has he been watching? And, so that was like a legendary story in our household. And I did watch the show. And it's funny, I did buy the comic, but much later. I'd say in the late 1970s, we got a used bookstore in town. It was called The Book Between. And I would go in there every day because they had a bin of quarter comics. And that bin would change every day, so you had to like run downtown all the time. And I was always, you might find this surprising, Rob, but I was never really buying the superhero comics. I was buying the weird comics. Yeah, I know. And I bought, you know, Mighty Samson and Atlas Seaboard comics and anything that was related to television. So like, you know, 6 Minute Our Man, Space 1999. And I was watching the reruns of Kotter every day at this time after school. So when I found those comics, I was like, oh my God, you know, I love Welcome Back, Kotter. So I grabbed, I think, two or three of them used. And I just remembered them being really good, like as a kid. And at that time, I don't know if you remember this. Well, you probably do. What am I talking about? I think Gold Key launched a Happy Days comic. And yes. I was super excited about that. And then, you know, I got it and it was so bad. The art was bad. The stories were bland and generic. And
well, that was the Gold Key kind of.
Oh, yeah. It was their MO. Well, you know, like, it's weird. They were hit or miss with some stuff. And but yeah, their Happy Days comic. And then you compare it to the DC Welcome Back, Kotter comic, and it's no comparison. It really, whoever, like the folks doing this actually gave it a really good try.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an excellent comic book. You know, I don't know how appealing it was or how well it sold, but nobody was phoning it in, is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that I came to realize after reading this book, and we'll get into the individual stories, this is actually really pretty good.
Yeah. You know, it's I was reading it today, and there's one story in there, I think called So Long, Kotter, where he's contemplating leaving.
Yes.
And dude, I'd have to read it. I remembered it. Like, I remembered it from when I was a kid. You know, and I remembered certain like lines in it, and you know, the sweat hogs stealing the groceries, essentially, like all of it. It was like, oh yeah, no, this is retained in my memory from, you know, 1978 or 9 when I read it the first time, and that's crazy.
It only ran 10 issues. The Welcome Back, Kotter
and
series.
I was surprised to see that. I didn't even know it ran that many issues.
It ran, and it had a lot of writers over its run. The different issues were written by Elliot S. Magan, Tony Isabella, Mark Evanier, who of course worked on Welcome Back, Kotter. He was a story editor for that show, I believe. And then
that might explain something,
right? Bob Toomey and Scott Edelman. So you had a lot of different writers kind of tackling this. The art would toggle back and forth between Rick Estrada, sometimes, and Bob Oxner. And the cover on this particular Treasury edition is by Bob Oxner. It's a wraparound cover doing his best Jack Davis.
That's exactly what I wanted to say. This has got that right bit of mad going on. Yeah.
They're in the city, and there's a million characters. There's construction workers.
There's lots of this and that. Yeah.
Cute girls. There's a dog chasing a cop. There's three triplet women doing their laundry out the window. There's a guy playing guitar. There's a guy in like a Condor Man kind of costume ready to take off. It's again, as a wraparound cover, as you were just saying, like, nobody's phoning this in. This was actually really pretty sharp. It's a really great image. And the likenesses are, it hits that sweet spot where it's like, it is cartoony versions of the characters you know, but you also completely recognize who they're supposed to be.
Yeah, it's something that Gold Key Happy Days did not do. And it's the right balance, because it kind of translates it into a fun comic.
Yeah.
I'm very fond of the art in this. It is that right. You know, it's not Archie, but it's just a little cut above that.
Mm-hmm. It's got some real life to it. Now, there was a Welcome Back, Cotter line for Mego.
No.
There wasn't?
There wasn't. Mego did Happy Days.
Right.
And okay. I kind of think, I think the whole thing really was the success of the Fonzie doll.
Sure.
Like Fonzie mania in general, it was massive. You know, that you can, most of us, if we were in of the around in 76, we had some Fonzie merch, you know? Yeah. And, I think when that happened, and Cotter was a ratings phenom as well, I think a very wise licensing agent kind of sold that as well. You know, it's sort of like the way, like, there was Battlestar Galactica, everything, because Star Wars. And I think that, you know, the popularity of John Travolta and these characters being very similar to that kind of, like, that kind of ilk, you know, they're young people, even though, like, I don't think they were actually technically all that young. I seem to remember some of them were like pushing 30 when they were playing high schoolers. There was some sort of, I think, cross appeal of the two characters. Like, you know, the sales of Happy Days and the Fonzie mania, this was the next best thing. And they thought it would be the next best merchandising hit. And I'm not really sure. Mattel picked up the Welcome Back, Cotter line. I believe it came out in 1977. Now I have to go check my
man. There was even a playset. There was a classroom playset. They really went all in.
It's actually kind of decent too. It's a well made. There's a playset, and in typical Mattel fashion, there's a motorcycle. It's Big Jim's motorcycle. There's all kinds of weird Sweat Hog merchandise out there. There is Azrak Hamway made a office set, so it's got like a paper tray with a really like a cartoony Gabe Kaplan pointing down, which I've joked about that I would like to make that a cat litter box. Because I just think that would be weird. There's another thing too. There's like here it is. There's a Bobberino pencil sharpener and a, this is real too. This really happened. And I forget, I think the calendar is Horseshack. I have no idea what Washington's a pencil holder. And Epstein is a stapler.
Amazing.
Your notes. And these exist. They're around. They're just the weirdest thing. And they're massive. I've seen them once. But yeah, the toy line came out in 77. I believe it lasted the entirety of 1977. There's a classroom and a motorbike, and I do not think it was a big hit.
No, I would guess not. I mean, what are you supposed to do with them, really?
There was, I just remember seeing them in a pool store. You know, like pool stores used to sell toys at Christmas sometimes. And I was not
familiar with that, but okay. You mean like, like a water pool, not pool, the game pool, like recreate, like a water.
Yeah. This was a weird thing that happened around here. And I think it happened in certain places in the States because, like places like Big Reds, they would sell pool supplies in the summer. And then around Christmas time, you know, pool sales would dry up.
So no, it makes like sense. Sure.
Toy stores briefly. And there was one of those in town. It's still there. They don't have any old inventory. But I just remember I was like 12 getting chlorine with my mom. And there was this wall of Horseshacks in there in the back.
That needs to be a name of something, Wall of Horseshacks. I don't know what it would be, a band or something, but it would be a great. That makes total sense when you say it. It's like, yeah, who's buying pool stuff in January? So
exactly,
gotta sell something. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
And the one thing I think that's really one of the neater bits of Welcome Back Cotter merchandise is the there's a Welcome Back Cotter street rod car. I think MPC again. They just re-released a model kit. They also, I think, re-released the Monkey Mobile as a Fonzie model kit too. But they come with little figures of the Sweat Hogs.
Oh, so it's they're small sized.
Yeah, little HO scale Sweat Hogs.
Wow.
With your car model.
Wow.
The Sweat Hogs Dream Machine, I think it's called. Yeah, there's some really neat merch. It really had quite the burn brightly, but not for a long time, merchandising explosion.
It's a shame that they never did a Mrs. Cotter action figure, because that was kind of everybody's favorite character. Say,
she's, and she's like in that, you know, the sort of the Bailey Quarters club, where she's, you know, one of the more unassuming, hotter women on television at the time.
Absolutely. And we'll talk about that a little bit in these stories, by the way. The one other thing I want to mention about this particular treasury, and the closest I had in a brush with fame, was a bunch of years ago when a bunch of us were at the Heroes Con in North Carolina. It was Shag was there, and Ryan Daly, and Chris Franklin, and Cindy Franklin, and it was a big blast. And John Travolta was a guest there.
Oh, no kidding.
And, yeah, he was signing things, and you could see him. Like, we walked by, and there he was, just sitting there. And I thought, and I walked by this dealer, and he was selling treasuries. And I thought, well, because I already own this treasury, but of course I didn't bring it with me. Why would I? And I'm going through the box, and I'm thinking, well, geez, if this guy has the Welcome Back Cotter treasury, if I can get this signed by John Travolta, like, that'll be a real trip. And I'm going through it, and he had it. And it was not, he had it in like a bag and a board or some sort of protective thing to keep it in, you know, decent shape. And it was in good shape. And he had no price tag on it. And I said, how much is this? And he goes, $50.
Oof.
And I'm like, I'm not dropping $50 for the gag of getting John Travolta to sign it. Of course, that was 4 years ago and the $50 is long gone. I kind of wish I had done it. But in the moment, I was like, that's a lot of money to spend for kind of a gag sort of thing, you know.
I never see treasury editions well priced. They're always especially at shows, you know, you pick one up and the guy wants like $150 for it, and it's like, I don't know if that's, but the Welcome Back Cotter I picked up probably at a show a few years ago for like $20.
That's good. Now that's a solid price for that.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought, oh, yeah, I'm buying that all day long. You know, it was a good shape, and it's a great, it's one of my favorite treasuries.
Yeah. So, all right, we're going to talk about the stories. There's four stories in this comic plus a sort of special bonus feature that is original to this treasury. Said after the cover, which I mentioned, you can see the cover on our website, finewaterpodcast.com. There is the inside cover is a page from Gabe Cotter's family album. And it's just basically some photos from the show, just some still photos from the show, and you see different things, and it's written in the pen of Mr. Cotter, supposedly. So the first story is called Nursemaid to a Doll. It's by Mark Evanier, Rick Estrada, and Bob Oxner. So while walking to school, late as usual, Epstein is harassed by some other kids who make fun of him. While attempting to defend himself, Epstein accidentally bumps into a fellow student, hitting her arm hard enough that he breaks it. As punishment, Principal Woodman orders Epstein to help the girl out by carrying her books from class to class. The young lady realizes she can get more out of Epstein and basically turns him into an indentured servant, having him rearrange the furniture in her bedroom and even holding her dolls out on the street while she goes shopping. Those same punks see Epstein holding a doll and go back to mocking him. Epstein blows his cool and beats the three jerks up, much to the delight of Woodman, who sees this as a perfect excuse to expel one of the sweat hogs. Mr. Cotter and the sweat hogs show up to the board meeting, which will decide Epstein's fate. Woodman calls the young girl to testify, but she refuses to rat him out. Woodman is furious, but Epstein's school career, such as it is saved. Later, Epstein thanks the girl, who realizes she had been treating him poorly and used this moment to apologize. Even later, Mr. Cotter has lost his voice from talking so long at the board meeting. However, this doesn't stop him from telling the other sweat hogs another hoary old joke, writing it on cards. So, okay, Brian, what did you think of this first story?
It's not my personal favorite in the series, but I do love the line, "In your ear with Rosie Greer." But yeah, it's a little bit of a departure from the show itself, but it's really kind of like energetically drawn and interesting to look at.
Oh, the art is great. Rick Estrada and Buck Obstner are a great team.
Yeah. Very animated.
Yeah, it's right. It has a real, as you said earlier, kind of like a Mad Magazine energy to it. The character, and the likenesses are clearly on, like they probably had likeness rights for everybody because it's close enough that you can tell. But again, it's not like where they clearly just did photos and like grafted it onto drawings. It was Estrada and Oxner had enough skills. Of course they did, because they're both great artists, to mimic the likenesses of the actors, but put them in a comic book world.
I think one of my favorite things about reading Gold Key Star Treks is finding the promotional shots.
Yeah.
Because there's the guy had like five pictures of Leonard Nimoy.
Right.
And there's just one of Spock that appears at least two times in every issue.
Nimoy doing.
Well, yeah, it's a face forward shot of Spock talking. And it's like, yeah, I know exactly. I've seen that still a million times. And it's just kind of, it's just that's the sign of a real quality comic book. Whereas in this, you're obviously, they're doing a great job.
Yeah. Now, I was curious about this story because I looked it up on Mike's Amazing World. And this story is not, all the other stories are reprinted from the series.
Right.
This one is not. This never appeared in the series. And I was curious where it came from. So I wrote to Mark Evanier, who wrote the story. And I surmised that was this an inventory story that they had left over from the book being canceled? And then they wanted to use it. And so Mark wrote back and said, when they decided to cancel the Welcome Back, Cotter regular series, they had one story left over and they decided to do the Treasury to make use of it. So that was kind of the impetus for doing the Treasury, was they had bought and paid for this story. And they were like, well, we paid for it. It's a waste to just let it sit in a drawer. So let's cobble together some reprints and make a treasury out of it. So this story ended up being kind of the reason the treasury exists in the first place.
No kidding.
Yep. I figured, because I was like, why would they have commissioned a brand new story just for this? Now, of course, DC eventually limited collector's edition would morph into all new collector's edition with Superman versus Muhammad Ali and Superman versus Shazam and Superman and his Incredible Fortress of Solitude, Batman versus the Hulk, but they were still mostly doing reprints. But here it's an original story. Now they don't mention that anywhere on the cover or anything. They let that slip by. They would say, featuring an all new Welcome Back, Cotter adventure or whatever. They don't bother to do that.
Yeah. That's interesting. You're right. They promote other features.
Yeah. And well, one of the other features is the very next thing, which is called On the Set with Welcome Back, Kotter, which is a little featurette drawn by Dan Spiegel and written by Mark Evanier, who, again, was the story editor on Welcome Back, Kotter. And it basically is kind of like an informational piece where it's Dan Spiegel drawing the actors as they're getting ready to do the show. And there's a little portrait of like John Sylvester White getting ready to play Woodman. And you see the director, you see the lunch crew, you have the catering table. You see Epstein there. There's a shot of Gabe Kaplan walking to work.
In his leisure wear.
And this was also original. This was done, and Mark Evanier commented on this too. He says the Spiegel section was commissioned for the Treasury. So this was another piece of original content that DC put together from Evanier and Spiegel, who of course collaborated on a million comic books together. This is also an original piece to the Treasury. And I love all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's actually some really interesting stuff too. I'm just kind of rereading it now. It's been a while. But yeah, I guess I wonder if he ever got the $1.75 that John Travolta owes him back.
There were certainly fan magazines and there was TV Guide and people had access to behind the scenes stuff, but it's not like it is today where, you know, you're just seeing it all the time. So this was still kind of a rare thing. And it reminds me a little bit of when they did the Super Friends Treasury.
I was going to say the top backdrop.
Here's the backstory of how a cartoon is made, written by Alex Toth. And this is similar
is it
to that.
Or Toth? I think it's Toth.
I think I say Toth sometimes, but I think it's Toth. But you know, it's kind of a similar thing of like, oh, you like Welcome Back, Kotter? Well, this is how they make Welcome Back, Kotter. So like, okay, so a little cute little 4-page sequence, very nice. So the next story is reprinted from Welcome Back, Kotter number 1. This is So Long, Kotter. You mentioned it earlier. It's by Elliot S. Magan, Jack Sparling, and Bob Oxner. So after some construction on a nearby building causes havoc at the Kotter's apartment, Mr. Kotter is overjoyed to see that the transfer he's been requesting for months has finally been approved. After being discovered making out in a closet with a fellow classmate, Barbarino sees the letter for a moment, only making out something about Kotter getting a physical examination. The Sweatogs immediately assume, wrongly, that he is sick, so they all snap into shape, attending class on time, and even paying attention. After speaking with Mrs. Kotter, who explains what is really happening, the Sweatogs come up with a scheme to get Mr. Kotter to stay. They round up Mr. Kotter's old teacher, Wayne Peavy, who reminds Kotter that he was a troublemaker in school, but Peavy never gave up on him. Realizing that he truly wouldn't be happier anywhere else, Kotter tears up the transfer. So, Brian, you said that you really you remembered this one from all the years past.
Yeah, I didn't really need to reread this. I remembered this story really well. There's a lot of memorable little points in it, and it's probably my favorite Welcome Back, Kotter comic. I love the way they draw Julie in this, too. There's a lot of little hijinks and little things going on, and it just, to me, it feels like an episode of the show.
See, that's interesting that you said that, because I thought, and I mean this as a compliment, I actually thought this was the kind of story that they would have, that only would have worked as a comic book, because it has a sort of fantasy sequence where Mr. Kotter like is confused and he thinks he's gone back in time because Mr. Peavy is sort of talking to him like he's a student again. And it's such a fanciful element that I think trying to do it in live action would have been weird, because it would have been like, well, he can't figure out that it's just Mr. Peavy as an old man. But in a comic book, it seems more palatable to go with the conceit.
Yeah, okay, I feel you on that. I guess they would have had to probably go do that in another way.
Right.
But I guess I just in general, you know, you can go a lot of these things, they try to go broad and tell stories the show would never tell, you know, but this one looks like it's filmed on the sets of the show.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like I find it's a believable concept and one of the more grounded comics in the series.
Sparling is much more, a little more beholden to the poses that he has of Gabe Kaplan.
Yeah.
There's a couple of panels where you're like, well, that looks like just like a photo that he just kind of drew over. Again, I don't mean to be insulting, but it's just, the body language is a little more stiff.
Yeah.
Because I think he's using more photo reference.
You know what? I hadn't really copped that, but you're absolutely right.
But it's a fun, I mean, again, and it's a fun story. And you get Mrs. Cotter, who again, as drawn by here, Sparling and Ochsner, is just gorgeous. I mean, it's, you know, she's your classic nerd crush because she's just so completely gorgeous. So, I mean, it really,
absolutely.
Instead, it's a fun story. It's a really, really cute little story. And then I love all the, you know, the Barbarino and the girl in the closet, which is fun. And it even works at the end of the story, even works in the lyrics to the theme.
That's right.
From the Welcome Back Cotter theme by John Sebastian.
And it actually happens again too.
Mm-hmm.
Right at the beginning of the next story.
Right. I mean, for people too young to remember, the Welcome Back Cotter theme was its own song by John Sebastian. Now, I don't, maybe you know this, Brian, was it released after the show as a single, or was it a song that existed and was used for Welcome Back Cotter?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay. Cause it was a genuine hit. Like you can still hear it on the radio every so often.
Yeah. Yeah. He was the Lovin' Spoonful guy.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
And he doesn't say Cotter in the song.
No,
welcome back is the refrain of it.
But yeah, it's a bit, I remember like the Greatest American Hero theme song.
Now, yeah, that was big.
Seemed to come out at the same time as the show, like the 45. I bought the 45 as a kid. And but it's been a long time since since I've actually thought about it, but I don't know. This song predates me, so I wouldn't, like, you know, I was four, so I can't quite remember if that was an established hit or not before. I'm sure it helped raise its presence.
Oh yeah. I mean, not to get off Welcome Back Cotter, but for you, since you just mentioned it, Greatest American Hero, how did that never make it as a comic book? How did that?
That's weird, eh?
I mean, had nobody thought to pick that up as the license? Like it's about a guy who's a superhero. Like, you would think Gold Key at least would have been like, hey, we can make some money out of this. I mean, come on.
I don't know how much Gold Key was doing in 81 when that
maybe so. But you know what I mean? It just seems like, think of all the properties that comic book companies tried to turn into, like Welcome Back Cotter. And yet, a show about a guy with an alien suit that had superpowers, nobody thought to make that into a comic book? That seems baffling. But okay, that's for another show some other day. The Greatest American Hero show will do. So anyway, speaking of stories that the show probably never could have done.
Yeah, here we go.
We're talking about the next one. The Return of Augie Borelli by Tony Isabella, Rick Estrada, and Bob Ochsner. This is from Welcome Back Cotter number 3. So Mr. Cotter receives a visit at his apartment from a very large, very scary man. He tells Mr. Cotter that an Augie Borelli will be at school tomorrow, and Cotter better be there or else. Mrs. Cotter asks who Augie Borelli is, and Mr. Cotter explains that Augie Borelli, the notorious gangster, was one of the original sweat hogs. Back in their school days, both he and Cotter went after the same girl, with Cotter ending up being the victor. A practical joke on Cotter's part landed Borelli in jail, who has been vowing revenge on his rival. Cotter is so nervous in class that the sweat hogs ask what they can do to help. Moments later, Borelli arrives, hulking goon in tow, and Barbarino is happy to see his uncle. Yes, Augie Borelli is Vinny's uncle. Borelli, in a three-piece suit with a swanky car parked out front, charms everyone in class, except Mr. Cotter, who still thinks of him as a criminal. Barbarino, insulted for his family, storms off. After class ends, two FBI agents arrive on the trail of Borelli. They turn to Cotter for info, and Barbarino overhears this. He gets so mad, he decks one of the FBI agents and berates Cotter for his supposed disloyalty. Later, Borelli returns where the FBI are waiting for him. They each pull out their guns, which angers Barbarino. He tries to tell his uncle that he can't do that, but receives a slap from his uncle in return. Borelli, with his pistol pointed at Cotter's head, whispers to him to slap the gun out of his hand. Cotter is confused, but does so, allowing the FBI to arrest him. Outside and out of earshot of Barbarino, Borelli explains that when he heard that his nephew assaulted an FBI agent, he was horrified at the idea that Barbarino would turn out like him. So he made a deal with the FBI that if they dropped the charges against his nephew, he'd turn himself in. As Borelli is led away, he compliments Cotter, saying that while he has immense wealth and power, Cotter has something Borelli does not, his nephew's respect. I look, I don't want to oversell this. I got to say, when I read this story, because I read this Treasury when I got it 20 years ago, and I don't really remember much from it. I probably just scanned it because I wasn't that big on it. But when I reread it for this Treasury, I was really impressed by this story. I mean, really impressed, in that it has a kind of a grim ending.
Yeah.
It's something that I can't imagine the show could have ever done.
It's a very special episode. I'm very fond of the panel of Barbarino yelling.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really nicely drawn.
That big close-up of him, yeah.
Yeah, big close-up. They're using real thick black lines. And
my Uncle Augie is a man about town, man in this town. It's a really good story, and it's nothing the show could have ever really done, partly because of the action beats. I mean, there's a couple of action scenes in it. I mean, you know, it's just gunplay, but that would have been really, really strange to see on the TV show. And again, it ends with this kind of the last panel of the story is Barbarino sitting in the classroom, which has been all the chairs have been knocked over because of the fight, crying because he's so upset over his uncle. And I'm like, I was completely stunned by it. I mean, it was so impressed that they were, as you said, Brian, like, they were not phoning this in.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were
really
trying to do something different.
Yeah. And it shows in this. I mean, you're right. This would never be an episode of the show.
No.
But they're trying to at least write something that seems almost true to the characters as well. You know,
yeah.
Mr. Cotter can't obviously disarm Augie. You know,
yeah,
there's
right.
some comedy there.
Because he's a coward. The Cotter's always a coward. That's a recurring motif, is that he's always, you know, he's afraid, and he's, you know, and there's a lot, there's even like a classic panel of Gabe Kaplan doing like the collar thing, like that kind of thing. I mean, it's, but yeah, I mean, it was really impressive. And aside from all the action beats, courtesy of Rick Estrada and Bob Oxer, there is some really good, as they used to call it, good girl art.
It's crazy
story.
And it's weird. It's a little odd. This Bambi thing is kind of hilarious.
There's like this redheaded girl that is sort of flirting with Mr. Cotter,
which is a little like
nowadays. I mean, you know, yeah,
yeah, that would not fly today. No. You know, but it's she actually at one point is like caressing his arm. You know, she's fooled by the Augie thing and is like, oh, Aries men are so powerful. And it's like, yikes.
Yeah. It's really pretty amazing. I mean, yeah, there's this one panel of her standing on next to his desk with an apple. And she's in like a bare midriff top and short shorts. And you're like, this is really pretty fetching.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Estrada and Oxner really know how to do it. I was so impressed by this story. That similar to Mark Evanier, I reached out to Tony Isabella to ask him about it. And I was sure that Tony did not remember this because, of course, as we all know, Tony Isabella has written 1,000 comic book stories. This was 50 years ago. But I was just like, hey, Tony, look, you probably don't remember this, but I got to say, this story really impressed me. And he actually did remember it. And this is what he had to say about it. He said, I remember this story well. It took me twice as long to write as a superhero comic book, but I was very satisfied with the results. Editor Joe Orlando loved it, but I couldn't afford to continue on the series. And then he mentions, now, by the way, he says that his memory is a little faulty here because obviously this was a long time ago, but this is what he remembers. He said, I actually pitched a story that was rejected by DC and which I later found out was also rejected by the TV series. Both myself and a writer on the show had pitched stories where one of the Sweatogs thought he'd gotten a girl pregnant. It was meant to be a humorous PSA.
Yeah. But they were all, they didn't get laid.
They couldn't have done all that. But like, I mean, again, I don't want to oversell it. This is not, you know, this is not Watchmen or anything, anybody, or Batman Year One. But it's just when you.
Horshack's Journal. Oh my God. Oh. We've written something here.
Tire tread burst on stomach. But I mean, look, when you buy a comic book called Welcome Back, Cotter, you're not expecting a lot. It's clearly a licensing thing, and we all know how the business works. And you're just like, all right, this will be a couple of laughs with some caricatures, but you're not expecting a whole lot. But this story is really solid. And you get to the Tony Isabella, really put a lot of work into it and made it something that you would have never, like I said, never seen on the show.
Exactly.
Yeah. I was, and again, that ending, I mean, can you imagine ending the show on this crying Barbarino and then cutting to welcome back? Welcome
oh no, they
back.
Wouldn't like, play music.
No, you know, yeah, it'd be silent. Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be silent. Like the very special night cards.
It's just like, I couldn't, as I'm sitting there reading, I'm like, where is this story going? And it was just, and again, the artwork is marvelous by Estrada and Ox. And again, some of the pages will be up on the website. It's just, it's really, really good. I mean, it's really, I liked all the stories, but that one I thought was just absolutely outstanding. So the final story is called Tyrannosaurus Rex. It's by Mark Evanier, Rick Estrada, and Bob Oxner. And it is from Welcome Back, Cotter, number 4. During their morning joke, Mr. and Mrs. Cotter are interrupted by Horshack, who comes storming into their apartment, hiding under the sofa. Mr. Cotter asks why he is there, and Horshack points out the window at a hulking brute walking the streets known as Tyrannosaurus Rex. Turns out that T-Rex is the school's gym teacher, Mr. Block, who is out looking for the sweat hogs. He rounds up Barbarino and Washington, screaming at them to get the class. After gym, all the sweat hogs are too exhausted to pay attention to Mr. Cotter's lesson, except for Epstein, who has produced a note, supposedly written from his mother, excusing him from gym. Cotter tries to talk Mr. Block into going a little easier on the sweat hogs, but he is having none of it. While Cotter says you could still be in shape with moderate exercise, Horshack boasts that the two teachers should race. The next morning, Cotter and Block are in matching jumpsuits, ready to see who is more fit. The sweat dogs pull every trick they can to help Cotter win, redirecting Block down a blind alley, sicking a cop on him, even throwing a banana peel under him. That last trick results in Block spraining his ankle. Cotter tries to help him, and then they talk. Block reveals that he always wanted to be a teacher, but lacked the brains to teach subjects like English and history, leaving only gym. Now, if he loses the race, he fears the kids will not respect him and he'll lose his job. Cotter decides to allow Block to win, and he hobbles across the finish line. Grateful, Block tells Principal Woodman that maybe he's been going at the kids too hard. Meanwhile, the sweat dogs can't understand how Mr. Cotter lost the race, even with all their help. So, all right, Brian, what did you think of this last story?
Well, first of all, it kind of mirrors real life in that, first of all, it's an Archie. But second of all, it kind of is hilarious because in real life, Gabe Kaplan beat Robert Conrad.
Now, I mean, infamous rivalry.
So this is so weird that this is in comic form. So maybe we, you know, maybe we missed an episode. They should have done this as an episode and got Bob Conrad on there. it's a bit, you know, it's a bit more, like I said, like an Archie.
Yeah.
It feels like one. But you know, it's still an entertaining read, I guess.
and it's got a little dollop of significance to it, and that Mr. Block is not a hard ass. Like, he wants to be a teacher, and he just is. He's too enthusiastic. Like, he's too into it.
Yeah,
and he doesn't know to not. You know, he doesn't know that you don't have to be a martinet to kind of get the best out of your students. And I thought that's nice. I mean, like that him and Gabe Kaplan, him and Mr. Cotter have that little moment together. I thought that was a nice bit. Art wise, it's interesting how it toggles around from very cartoony, where the way they draw Mr. Block, he looks like a character out of Ren and Stimpy almost. Like, he's so
cartoony. I was gonna say he kind of sticks out in this world because he not even has like human proportions.
Yeah, right. He's massive. I mean, he looks like a He-Man figure almost. And then there's a panel with Mr. Woodman where Horshack is walking behind him and coughing, and I swear it looks like the page was like inked by Neil Adams. Like, it's photorealistic of the actor. You know, and you're like, is this the same world as Mr. Block?
Mr. Block is he like is he like a cartoon character and the rest of the people are real?
Yeah, it's very, very strange. But nevertheless, it's very, very funny. And again, it is, as you said, it is very Archie-like.
And Bambi's back.
Yeah, right. And Bambi's in the... Yeah, Bambi's back in the story. Actually, in fact, MASH did a very similar story in one of their last seasons where Father Mulcahy has to race a guy from the 863rd, and the guy that they get is a ringer. And so he's just running circles around Mulcahy. And then at one point they jog together because the ringer is humoring Mulcahy, and Mulcahy kind of like pours not poison in his ear, but kind of talks his ear off and says, well, you know, I'm doing this to help the orphans, and he softens the guy up. So he throws the race. So it's a story trope that a lot of TV writers couldn't resist of having two of course this was not an episode, but the same idea of having, you know, our hero and our villain jogging together, and like, oh, they find out more about each other when they have the moment.
Yeah, that I remember that episode. This is a weird side tangent, but it's something you'll appreciate. As a kid, I had a dream I had Gold Key MASH comics.
Oh, if only.
And I can't believe they just never went for that.
No, they did. There was so much merchandising for that show in the last couple of years, but never a comic book, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I would have loved that. Oh, boy. A DC TV comic. But that said, so overall, it's a fun story. And again, it's written by Mark Evanier, who obviously knew these characters very well because he was writing the real versions on television. It's got that kind of Evanier touch, which is a little bit of a character moment for Mr. Yeah. Block, that we find out that he's not such a bad guy. Did you notice, though, throughout these stories, and maybe because these are only reprinted from 3 issues out of the 10, that Washington is kind of barely in these stories? It really focuses on mostly Cotter, who, of course, was the star, and Barbarino, who, obviously, as played by Travolta, was the breakout star. I mean, he was such a breakout star that it ended him a movie career, and he left the show. But Washington, of the 4 Sweat Dogs, seems to be barely in these stories.
Yeah, actually, now I kind of want to know what the other stories were like if there's 7 other stories.
Yeah.
I was kind of going through the covers, and I don't remember those, like, at all. And I wonder if they had, like, really low distribution rates towards the end.
I probably, as books get canned, you know, as they head towards cancellation, they less and less. I'm glad you said that, though, because that was something else I wanted to bring up. And this is just anecdotal, because there's no way, at least I know, to do research on this, because how would you ever find out? But the beloved, I put that in air quotes, comic 3-packs that were done in the 70s.
Yeah.
If you go on eBay, and again, this is not...
I collect those, by the way.
Me too. Yeah. They're expensive, so it's hard for me to collect them.
They're insane.
Oh, yeah, the prices are nuts now for those things. But it's like I don't have an Excel spreadsheet to say this is genuine. It only feels like what I've seen. But if you look at the DC 3-packs, it seems disproportionate that they feature a Welcome Back, Cotter comic. You know, disproportionate to how long that series ran versus how many other series DC had. It seems like Cotter was in there a lot. And I'm like, was that because those were sold in department stores? Was Cotter more of a department store comic because it had more, maybe they thought it had more of a broad-based appeal because it was on television, as opposed to, you know, putting in a comic book that only kids would know? I mean, again, I'm just totally pulling this out of thin air.
Well, I think you're onto something too, because Archie sold really well at grocery stores.
Sure, of course.
And those comic packs, like maybe what they were trying to do was grab, like I think a girl could read a Welcome Back, Cotter comic just like a boy. Like I think the appeal is there, sort of like Archie.
Yes.
In that it's about teenagers. And yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if there was like this is a family friendly comic that may appeal to both genders.
Right. And they're one and dones. You know, you don't have to read
six months. There's no continuity or, you know, like there's no crisis on Infinite Cotters.
Right. You know, like Silver St. Cloud, who's that? You don't have to know any of that. It's just a Cotter comic. But it's when every so often when I feel like I'm throwing some money at something, I go on eBay and I look at comic packs and I see if I can find one cheap. I never can because they're like $50 a pop now. That's just
ridiculous. I haven't bought one in years. It all started. There was a local flea market and the guy had the Micronauts one.
Mm.
And I was, how much is this? Like $10. And I was like, oh my God.
Deal.
And I have a few really good ones. Like a lot of them are the ones with like graphics relating to the program on them. Like Star Wars. I have one of the Star Wars ones and I have the Shogun Warriors and one Gold Key Star Trek one. My dad famously used to distribute those.
Whoa!
And he was friends with the guy who I think brought them into Canada. Like, he had a warehouse full of them. And like my dad, the ones my dad sold a lot of were the Marvel Classic Comics, like the Classics Illustrated.
Oh,
I remember those really well. And I can remember, like, my dad stopped selling them, but we went to go visit his friend. And his friend goes to me, I'm probably like 10 or 11 at the time. And his friend goes, take as many as you want. And I look at my dad, who's standing behind him, and my dad's holding up like one finger, like, take one.
Oh.
And
No.
Yeah, I took one. You know, I'm not going to tick my dad off, but yeah, I could have taken a case that day, and that kills me. But yeah, we kind of grew up with those, and we always had those around. And I have very fond memories of getting the Star Wars one with the Hunter in it. That
cyborg the robot guy. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's my favorite. It's like my second favorite issue of Star Wars. Is that?
That is my favorite issue of Star Wars.
Pulls his face off at the end. Oh, yeah. It's great.
I bought when my son turned like 7, he was into Star Wars, and I bought him a copy of that for his birthday, because it's like, I want you to have what I had when I was 7, you know. And I would kill to have that in the 3-pack.
Oh man, yeah.
Yeah, I don't have that one in the 3-pack. I forget. I think I can't remember which Star Wars 3-pack I have, but it's the other one, you know. And I would really like that one. But it was kind of cool. Like whenever my dad, this was one of my dad's closest friends who distributed these things. And whenever like they would go visit, they would come home with, you know, Condor Man, or, you know, just like some random 3-pack of comics. And I always like, that's a very special part of childhood for me. I didn't know about Cotter being in them so much, but now I'll never unsee them, I'm sure.
Again, I may be completely wrong. It may just be, maybe I'm seeing the same auctions over and over again or something, but just proportionate to how small the Cotter series was compared to the larger DC publishing line, I feel like I saw it more than you would expect. You know,
I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think it, especially if you really want to add in the fact that they decided to do a treasury.
Yeah.
Of something that failed. That there was some sort of like, well, this will sell better in a drugstore or a toy aisle. Like
at a higher price point. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a really good comic book.
Yeah.
I mean, again, and I didn't want to come into it and like besmirching it, you know, like, come on.
Yeah, that's why you won't have me for the Superman Bicentennial.
Yeah. But like, it's really a solid collection of humor comics.
Yep.
And that was a dying art outside of Archie. That was a dying art in 1978. And so overall, this is a really solid package from the all-new cover by Bob Oxner, from the bonus features talking about the show. The Inside Back cover features a photo of the Sweat Hogs and Mr. Cotter, and he's telling some of his bad old jokes. It's a really good book. I mean, it's really one of the more successful DC treasuries in terms of its sort of coherence.
Yeah, it is a solid, it was worth $2, let me tell you.
Oh man, yeah. Well, yeah. I wish I had dropped the 50 and gotten Travolta to sign it. It would have been marvelous, but okay. So that's the Buck and Beck Cotter Treasury, everybody. You can check, again, there's going to be images of it on our website, finewaterpodcast.com. So Brian, I mean, thank you for doing this. Thank you so much for sort of calling your shot so early on. I mean, it only took 60 episodes to get to it from when you asked me about it the first time. But I'm glad we finally got to this, because this is a great book.
I had completely forgotten that. I can't believe it's been that long. It felt like last year we did the Joe episode.
Yeah, that's like episode number 4 of something of Treasury Cast. And then, yeah, you were like, if you ever do Cotter, I want to be your man. And I was like, wow, all right.
Figured it would be a short list, too. I mean, it's not like I want Superman versus Spider-Man.
You know, a lot of people asked about Cotter. This is, I'm probably causing a little bit of gnashing of teeth by some people out there, because they didn't get to do it. But it's like, again, you were first, and I tried and do dibs that way. But it was like, this obviously was quite beloved to a lot of people, because more people asked for this than you would have expected from a Welcome Back Cotter treasury.
Yeah. So this was real. This was really fun, and I'm glad to be here.
Thank you so much for doing it. So, Brian, not that people don't already know, but why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Oh, on the internet. You can find me at plaidstallions.com.
There you go.
And I have a YouTube channel called Brick Mantooth. I should probably call it Plaid Stallions. and we have a podcast called Pod Stallions that we do. We do two Halloween themed episodes every October. And I do that with my good friend, Jason Lindsay. And I'm also available at toyventuresmagazine.com, which is our publication.
That's a marvelous magazine. It's so much fun. You know what? Again, no one here that's listening to this doesn't know what Toy Ventures is, but why don't you explain it just for a second, what Toy Ventures magazine even is?
It's an old school toy magazine that I missed toy magazines. So I thought, I'm going to make a toy magazine that I'd read, which is unfortunate because then I end up laying it out and reading it all the time. But, I have friends who jump in and do pieces. That's wonderful. And we just focus on 60s, 70s, and 80s toys. And, we go for the more obscure things. We don't want to talk about, He-Man. We want to talk about Warrior Beasts because everyone's done He-Man. And that's, like right now I'm doing a piece for issue 6 with another collector on Micronauts jewelry, which was a thing that came out. And I can't be happier doing stuff like that. If anyone wants to check us out, we got a website, we've got a Facebook page, Toy Ventures Magazine.
It's enormously fun magazine, everybody. Check it out. And our network's own Chris Franklin has done some pieces for it.
Much to my chagrin, my wife's favorite piece ever in the magazine was done by Chris Franklin, and I believe her second favorite piece was done by my friend and co-editor Corey Lachat. So I'm third.
Well, the one thing about Chris, if you get Chris started on sourcing artwork, off to the races like that. He gets really excited when he starts talking about how to, what panel from what comic did this thing was used on this toy packaging. And, you wind him up and there off he goes. So,
it completely shows. And I can't wait to have Chris back. He wanted to do something on the Super Juniors in the last issue. But we were doing a thing on Baby Frankenstein, which, it's like, that's just too much Scrappy-Doo type characters, So I hope to have him back very shortly for that.
I'm sure that'll be awesome.
It's
a fun magazine, everybody. You should absolutely check it out. So that is going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I want you to stay tuned. I'm going to play some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Welcome, one and all, to the Fire and Water Racetrack and Arena. Please direct your attention to the center of the track, where you will see 36 buses lined up between two ramps, a tank full of live man-eating sharks, and a high wire stretching over it all. The rocket cycle is warmed up and all the nets have been removed. Who would attempt these stunts just to entertain and inspire his audience? What kind of man? What kind of hero? There, coming in on a rocket-powered skateboard, it's the death-defying human Flycast! Join me, Max Romero, and a rotating roster of guests as we dive headfirst into the colorful comics of Marvel's The Human Fly. The death-defying Human Fly cast is a limited episode podcast spotlighting the adventures of a man who comes back from a crippling auto accident to become a mysteriously masked stuntman with a mission to inspire others to never give up hope. We'll also talk about the real-life Human Fly, a daredevil with a murky past and a desire to be the best stuntman in history, until the day he just disappeared. The actual Human Fly would vanish as suddenly as he had materialized, but not before sparking a comic series featuring what would be the wildest superhero ever, because he was real. The Death-Defying Human Fly cast, coming soon to the Fire and Water Podcast Network. It's gonna be wild.
Greetings, guys and ghouls. I'm the Invisible Dan Colon, and this is The Monsters That Made Us. Join Monster Mike Manzi and I on the last Friday of every month as we celebrate all of the spooktacular characters and films in the Universal Studios classic monster series. From The Phantom of the Opera to The Creature Walks Among Us, we sink our teeth into all the gory details as we dissect the films that gave us some of the most iconic movie monsters of all time. The Monsters That Made Us is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For more information, head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
And we're back with listener feedback, and these are the comments we got on episode 61 of Treasure Cast, The Savage Fists of Kung Fu, with my special guests Max Romero and Ryan Daly. First up, we got a comment from Robert J. Smith, who asks, so how do you pronounce Doug Mensch's name? Rob pronounced it so that it rhymed with hick, but Ryan pronounced it so that it rhymed with bench, which is how I always thought it looked. And then Max Romero followed up, and he says, according to a pronunciation guide at a 1984 Marvel Age, Mensch is pronounced Mensch. So I know that's very confusing because I just said it a couple different ways. I always heard it as Menick, but according to Max's comment that it's pronounced Mensch, Marvel Age presumably knows the right way to say it. So going forward, I will try to remember to say his name as Doug Mensch, not Doug Menick. So thanks everybody for that. Matt Ebb says, another delightful Treasury cast. I have very little to offer in the way of commentary as I've not read this Treasury and I've only recently started exploring Shang-Chi. I think as a kid, martial arts comics were a weird concept to me. I loved kung fu movies, but the sheer dynamism that genre seemed to work best on the screen rather than the page. I appreciate them much more now. However, I did want to say that, like Rob, I too only really knew of the Sons of the Tiger from the Fantastic Four roast, although over in the UK, it was called Fantastic Four Winter Special, printed treasury size with a glossy card cover and had a backup Doctor Strange story. My mind immediately went to that scene as soon as their name was mentioned. And then I started thinking about the all-seeing eye of Alan Funt and Dr. Doom blowing up Mount St. Helens. Matt, I have to say your comment made my hair blow back, if I had any, that the Fantastic Four roast was A, printed in England, and B, printed as at a treasury size. This is shocking information. I went on eBay to look for it, but I was not able to find it. But man, I have got to get a hold of that. I mean, I love that comic. And then the idea of seeing it, all those different artists at treasury size, that just, I mean, that's worthy of covering here on the show. So anybody out there, if you happen to know where I can track down a copy of the Fantastic Four roast / winter special in the British UK treasury size edition, please let me know. I am dying to get that book. So thank you for the information, Matt. Dr. Ant says, another great episode about another treasury I didn't know existed. Even as a kid, I was more of a DC guy than a Marvel guy, but I've always liked street-level martial artists. Surprisingly, my Marvel character of choice was always Iron Fist, maybe because I walked the superhero / street-level tightrope. Most of the issues I bought were at yard sales. And I'll say that the Marvel team-up two-parter with Iron Fist and the Daughters of the Dragon still ranks as one of my favorite stories ever. I happen to cross White Tiger here and there. But Shang-Chi has never crossed my hands as a reader, even though I was also enamored of that house ad you talk about. So hearing how it is Bruce Lee on some secret service makes me very interested. Is there a good starting place, an essential or something? Now to veer into the weird. I also ran into Sons of the Tiger here and there. I made up the oddest headcanon. In a later season of the Brady Bunch, there was an episode that looked like a backdoor pilot where Ken Berry adopts three sons, an Asian American, an African American, and a white kid. A cursory look says it was season 5 called Kelly's Kids. In my head, those kids grew up to be the Sons of the Tiger. I mean, we never heard from them again. So it's possible, isn't it? Could Ken Berry be some sort of crazy sensei? Anyways, thank you for giving me a forum to share that nuttiest of ideas. Wow, Ange. I have only seen a handful of episodes of Brady Bunch. It was just not really in the rotation of reruns that I watched as a kid. So I'm not as familiar with it as a lot of other people from my generation. But I really got to track down that episode. That sounds really funny. And Kelly's Kids was the original name of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Ado Bosnar says, congratulations to Martin. I was referring to, of course, that Martin was the winner of the Laugh Olympics Treasury contest from last episode. He says, I very much enjoyed the show covering another treasury I didn't know existed until I saw it on Rob's treasury site. I like the idea of reprinting stories from the black-white magazines in color in the treasuries, as Marvel also did in some of the Conan treasuries. However, judging by the reactions of podcasting's Sons of the Tiger, some better stories could have been chosen. Speaking of the Sons, I think I first heard of them in a White Tiger backup, probably in Spectacular Spider-Man, in which his origin was recounted, or in the pages of Power Man and Iron Fist, when Bob Diamond made a guest appearance as Danny Rand's sparring partner. I never gave them much thought, to be honest, but after listening to the show, I have to agree with whoever they said they had a sort of Mod Squad feel about them. And finally, some notes on your art comments. Later Gil Kane is always better than earlier Gil Kane. And while I agree that the cover may not be remarkable in comparison to the many wonderful covers Kane produced, it's still quite good. On Mike Vosburgh, I have to say that his art is always better in projects than he was enjoying rather than just getting a paycheck. If you want to see how good his work can be, check out DC's short-lived 1970s Sword and Planet series Starfire, or the equally short-lived Sisterhood of Steel published under Marvel's Epic imprint in the 1980s. Well, that was really serendipity there, Ado, because of course, between the previous episode of Treasury Cast and this episode, Shag and I covered the Starfire series over on the Who's That Show, and we talked a lot about Mike Vosburgh, so that all just worked out. Matt Saroy says, I just got back from the movie and really enjoyed it. It follows the Marvel movie formula and certainly turned Shang-Chi into a superhero. It really delves into magic, mysticism, and other dimensions. Going by what I learned listening to this episode, it certainly seems to stray from the comic. My knowledge of Shang-Chi couldn't fill Thumbelina's thimble. He was still being published when I started reading comics, but I stuck mostly to Spider-Man and the JLA and Star Wars for my first few years. By the time I opened up my comic reading horizons, his series had ended. It wasn't until he had a story in Marvel Comics Presents that I ever read a comic with him in it. Anyways, another great episode. Thank you very much. Brian Linton says, I had a chance to listen to this episode before seeing the movie with my family this evening. I'd heard of Shang-Chi before, but had never read a comic in which he appeared. As a result, the background he provided on the character was much appreciated. All I'll say about the movie is that all of us enjoyed it, even my wife, who only went out of a long love for me and our daughter. Chris Franklin, of course, from our network, says, great show, guys. I only knew about Shang-Chi by osmosis as a kid. That's everybody's been saying that. I bumped into Iron Fist and Power Man through Marvel Team-Up, but never really read any Shang-Chi stories. It wasn't until years later that I learned it was basically a sequel to the series of sequel series to Fu Manchu. Then I realized why he had kind of disappeared. The dreaded licensing red tape. Oh, and the horrid racial stereotypes. This issue looks like a lot of fun. I should definitely check out some classic Shang-Chi comics on the Marvel Universe app. I know the movie's quite different, but I really dug it, so I'm jazzed about learning more. Dick Giordano did a bit of work for Marvel in the 70s, but as Rob pointed out, it's mostly non-traditional. He and Roy Thomas produced an excellent adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula novel that ran in the Dracula Lives! Black and White magazine, and a few other horror mags before petering out before conclusion. Thankfully, the duo was able to get back together 30 years later and finish the project, which I believe is still in print. Can't recommend it highly enough. Andy Leyland says, according to the Epic Collection, ads for this Savage Hands Treasury appeared in Marvel Comics in December 1975. Thanks for the info, Andy. I'm going to have to go back and find some of my comics from that era and see if I can find an ad. I don't ever remember seeing an ad. I've been kind of getting into the habit of grabbing the ads and putting them in the gallery post as well. Of course, we did an episode about Marvel ads, but again, I've never seen an ad for Shang-Chi. I can dig one up if I look a little harder. Thank you, Andy. Brett Young says, I love Treasury Cast. Nothing beats a giant comic book on your lap when you're a kid. I have a pile of treasuries in varied conditions, as I've never found a good way to store them. My first and all-time favorite is Spider-Man and the Hulk at the Winter Olympics, so I'm anxiously awaiting that episode. I just saw the Savage Fist of Kung Fu treasury hanging up at my local comic shop for way too much money, so that was a no. But I was able to find the magazines on Marvel Unlimited. Most of the magazine articles are included, too. That's nice. They even have visual instructions on learning Kung Fu. I'm going to memorize these moves and then go beat up some local toughs. I assume I'll be able to recognize them from their mohawks and torn sleeves. The Fantastic Four Roast is also the first time I heard of Sons of the Tiger. That book was so cool to read through as a kid with a different hero and artist on every page. I didn't get half the jokes at the time, but I read that book to shreds. If I took it out of the bag now, it would fall into pieces. Brett, I'm hoping that you survived your encounters with local toughs enough to comment on this episode. Let us know if you're okay. Captain Entropy says, Sons of the Fire and Water, thanks for a very entertaining episode. There were so many outstanding Iron Fist and Shang-Chi stories in the 70s, I wonder if they should have waited a year or two and drawn from the comics as well as the magazine. This sounded like a mediocre crop overall. That said, I love these characters, and I'm happy the treasury exists. I never got interested in Master of Kung Fu until I was older, and then it was harder to get because of the issues you mentioned. I'm hoping trade paperbacks will be more available now because of the movie. More recently, Shang-Chi had a terrifically entertaining run in Secret Avengers. I saw a cosplayer at a con wearing the traditional Iron Fist costume. The skin-tight outfit with the open chest, hey baby collar, and slippers look way more objectifying in real life than it did on the comics page. The Shang-Chi movie and all the actors in it were great, but it does put Shang-Chi more in a superhero world and less in the world of pulp villains and British intelligence. I miss that pulpier milieu, and I hope he'll visit it in a future movie. The most important thing was that they got Shang-Chi right, a young man with a strong conscience, gifted at violence, with no desire to dish it out. Thank you. I eagerly await the next Treasury Cast. Well, thank you so much, Captain. Martin Gray says, isn't that typical? I leave the UK for a week and spotty Wi-Fi means I can't download podcasts to hear I've won a prize. Thank you, Rob. Thanks for another great show with splendid guests to answer Ryan's question. Nah, I never saw this treasury in the UK. I love this episode, having started out resenting Shang-Chi for not only stealing half the Avengers pages in their UK weekly, but for getting top billing. The Avengers starring Master of Kung Fu to loving the character. It made sense to cash in on the Kung Fu craze while saving the weekly from running out the Avengers to reprint. It had been using them at the rate of 52 per year. Eventually, Marvel US allowed the actual Master of Kung Fu color books to sell in the UK, and I jumped in as Mike Zeck joined Doug Mensch. Ah, see, I got it right. What an immersive experience that was. The book got even better with the intricate artwork of the late Gene Day. I'm now the happy owner of the omnibuses. I don't know. And then finally, we got a comment from Stevensky, who says, thanks to Rob and company for a terrifically entertaining episode. I must admit that although I was keenly aware, having been a kid in the 70s, of the Master of Kung Fu comics, perhaps even owned one or two, my familiarity with Shang-Chi was quite weak. Prior to listening to you gentlemen discuss the history of the character was a welcome education and has now sparked an interest in seeking out some reprints, though I gather that will be a daunting task. Heck, I now even want to see the new film. I've been somewhat MCU'd out following Endgame, but the positive things I've heard coupled with this episode may bring me back into the fold. Thanks again. P.S. I prefer to go big and then go home. Is that a problem? No, Stevensky, not a problem at all. Thank you so much for commenting. So that is going to do it for the feedback we got, again, on the website, finewaterpodcast.com for episode 61. So that's pretty much going to do it for this episode of Treasury Cast. A huge thanks to Brian Heiler for coming by and talking Welcome Back, Kotter with me. As I mentioned at the top of the show, actually like a much better book than I ever would have imagined. So you never know what you might find in these Treasury comics. You can find all the back episodes of this show on our website, finewaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to Treasury Cast on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking treasuries over on Twitter at Treasury Comics. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you're going to lock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Jeff Pollier and Brett Young for their support of Treasury Cast. I really do appreciate it. And Brett, like I said, I hope you're safe. So that is going to do it for this month. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will see you next time. But until then, go big or go home.
Honey, why hasn't your mother ever liked me?
She likes you, Julie. It's just she never was crazy about any girls I went out with. They were either too fat, too skinny, too short, too tall, too loud, too quiet. But I finally found a girl that was exactly like my mother. I mean, how could she complain? This girl looked like my mother. She talked like my mother. She walked like my mother. Same personality.
Well, what happened?
My father hated her.
Welcome Back, Kotter has been recorded live on tape before a studio audience. We'll be right back.